It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll find out why it looks like a ballot redesign won't be in the works before the upcoming election.
First, there's been a lot of news lately about how the internet can be a hostile environment for women, from stolen nude photos to threats and harassment.
These instances of harassment in the virtual world can have real-life effects on the victim. Some even consider them hate crimes.
Our next guest lays out the problems and what some women and online communities are doing to try to turn things around.
Danielle Keats-Citrin is a professor of law at the University of Maryland Law School, and she's the author of a new book called Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Danielle, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me aboard.
Well, we talked to you back in January about the harassment women are facing online, and since then there have been a lot of high-profile examples of harassment that have gotten very ugly, including the nude celebrity photo leak. There was Zelda Williams, the daughter of Robin Williams, who left Twitter for a while after some harassment. Is the problem getting worse since we spoke last, or is this just par for the course these days?
Yeah, you know, the problem, I think, over time has gotten worse, and we're increasingly seeing the posting of nude photos of both, of course, celebrities, but individuals, you know, the everyday person. And what is heartening, though, and maybe, you know, your question was, are we seeing more of it? I also think part of it, too, is that we're paying more attention to it. You know, for years I've been writing about online harassment, and so often the response has been, turn your computer off. Boys will be boys. It's the internet, the Wild West. But, you know, I think we're increasingly paying attention to just how harmful it is. So it's increasingly prevalent because these network tools are so easy to use to, you know, essentially ensure that people are unemployable, undateable, and really at risk for physical harm. But I think we're also taking it more seriously.
It's interesting you talk about the boys will be boys attitude or silly kind of frat boy humor was sort of analogous to the way we used to view sexual harassment in this culture.
That's exactly right. So, I mean, sadly, the responses to online harassment for years have lined up so precisely in the way that we responded to sexual harassment in the workplace in the 60s and early 1970s, right? So we said, oh, it's a perk for men to enjoy in the workplace. It's what you expect, right? And we used to say about online harassment, it's the Wild West. It's the internet. You know, you can't really expect anything differently, right? And we once said that sexual harassment in the workplace, it's just these messy interpersonal matters. You know, we should say nothing about them. That's private issues. And we often say the same about online harassment. Oh, it's too messy to get involved. It's just, you know, pranks, juvenile nonsense. And we often blame victims much in the way that we did in the 1960s and 70s. So we said to women in the workplace then, oh, it's what you're wearing, you kind of asked for it, and if you don't like it, leave the workplace. And we say the same thing to victims today, right? We hear it even with this leak, you know, the theft of women's nude photos. It's the theft and hacking, right? And the response is, I was just on a radio show yesterday, and a sheriff said, well, really, you shouldn't take your nude photos, right? And so in some respect, what we're doing is saying, we're blaming victims. We're saying you shouldn't have the right or the liberty, if you want, right, to take photos that you don't share with anyone, right, and keep them for yourselves. And so it's just sadly lining up with the very same ways in which we've trivialized and minimized sexual harassment offline. We're doing the same online.
So as you pointed out, there's been a lot of different response to the leaks of these nude celebrities, women. Some people have blamed Apple, the hackers, some of them saying, you know, message to celebrities, don't take nude photos.
Yeah.
And other people have said, well, no, a woman should be able to own her sexuality, and this is part of it, but it should never have to be made public. How do you view what happened, and also from a legal standpoint?
Right. So, I mean, this is a question I have. Do we say to individuals whose social security numbers have been hacked in data breaches and whose SSNs then are traded and bought or appear online, do we say to them it's their fault that they shared their social security numbers with their banks or with, you know, their employer? We don't. We shouldn't say the same thing to people who have a rightful expectation of privacy, that privacy is invaded and then posted online. So I don't think we should treat the information any differently, but I think it's stereotypes and gendered stereotypes that lead us to that conclusion, right? So what's the legal significance of posting nude photos online was part of your question, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's both a tort and increasingly in some states, it's a crime. So, you know, there isn't, when we think of the First Amendment, we protect we have every right to say very offensive and very hateful things. But there are certain categories of speech as a historical matter, we say, you know, we have less rigorous protection over them. And for private communications, we can protect private communications because essentially it's fostering private speech. So there are torts like public disclosure of private fact that when there have been sex videos of celebrities leaked, courts have both provided remedies and enjoined the release of those sex tapes. Because even celebrities have a right to privacy in their most intimate moments, and the public has no legitimate interest in them. You know, over the last 18 months, there has been a move to criminalize invasions of sexual privacy. So there are now 14 states in which it's a crime to knowingly post someone's nude images, knowing that they expected them to be private and that they were shared in confidence or permitted to be taken in confidence, and that confidence is betrayed. I don't think Wisconsin is one of those states, there are moves to criminalize it across the country, and I think that's exactly right.
Is there evidence that online bullying, threats, harassment has real-life harm?
Absolutely, right. So these threats online and just the pervasive privacy invasions and lies that are spread about people, it's terrorizing, right? So some people fundamentally change who they are. Victims have changed their names because the first 10 pages of a Google search of their name is saturated with their nude photos and the suggestion they're interested in sex. They've moved because their home address is posted online, along with lies about them that they're prostitutes or available for sex, right? And it's hijacked people's careers. So, you know, I've talked to countless professionals who have lost clients, patients, and some individuals have lost their jobs. So teachers have been fired. And schools have explained, like, look, your nude photo appears online. We don't believe you put it up there, but we can't have an elementary school teacher having parents look at, you know, a teacher's, you know, Googling a teacher and seeing these nude photos. And Microsoft did a study in 2009 and found that over 80% of employers, you know, use Google as an employment, you know, research tool. And over 80% of cases, there's a negative result. And one of the key categories of why employers explain there's a negative result when they use Google as kind of a CV is unsuitable photographs. So it's not that I don't think employers necessarily believe that individuals are spreading lies about themselves and putting up their nude photos you know, that they're engaged in this information. It's just so much safer and easier to hire someone who doesn't come with this kind of baggage. And it's emotionally devastating to victims. Some victims have told me they're like, they can't stop Googling themselves for fear that more posts are going to go up. And it fundamentally chases people offline. So it's silencing. You know, we think of all the wonderful things that the internet offers us. And a key part of that, right, is self-expression and promotion and establishing your online reputation. And so many victims just plug out of online life because the more that they establish themselves, the more they're attacked.
Now, you go after this from a legal standpoint. I'm curious about what you think about the English classics professor Mary Beard, was just profiled in The New Yorker about how she engages her attackers. Now, she's a public personality in England, and she gets a lot of really vile comments. Some of them are threats. But she, first of all, directly engages the people who are attacking her, and she also directs her followers, of whom she has tons because of her figure, her position.
Right.
And tells them, you know, to go after some of the people who are coming after her. And it's been pretty effective. This is not anything that happens within the bounds of law. But I wonder what you think about that approach.
Right. I mean, self-help certainly has its virtues. But let me explain why I think Mary Beard has been successful. I mean, so often, as she was explaining in that New Yorker piece, she's written directly to her attackers. So presumably she knows who they are or can figure out who they are. But so often the victims that I talk to, they have, you know, they're not celebrities or well-known individuals, and they have no idea who anonymous attackers are. And so it's virtually impossible to write back and say, you know, if somebody sets up an attack site in your name or a fake online advertisement saying you're interested in sex, like, who do you write to say, no, I'm not interested in sex, and please stop posting this, right? There's no really counter dialogue to engage in. So my sense of that story was that, you know, when she would reply via Twitter, you know, she could identify these folks or it, through other means. But so often victims have no idea who to engage with. And some of self-help, like, you know, just either having a dialogue, I think would be really valuable, right? Because victims would feel empowered. But the hard thing is that when I've had so many cases, and I discuss them in my book, where victims try to strike back, whether it's countering the messages that are sent about them, or even just establishing their own online presence in a positive way, mobs and individuals strike back even harder. So when individuals try, right, to protect themselves or even just to have a positive online presence, the strike back is so profound. So it's not that you can't have supporters help you and engage in counter Google bombs, right, to raise the prominence of positive things that's said about you online, but that's the rarer case.
Well, we're talking right now with Danielle Citrin about online harassment of women, why it happens and what to do about it. Thinking about this in light of the recent nude celebrity leaks that we've heard about recently, what happened recently with Emma Watson when she launched the He for She campaign at the UN. And we want to know what you think about this. Are you a woman who's been harassed online? Do you think the internet is a safe place for women? Do you feel that women are unfairly targeted by cyberbullies? And what do you think should happen, if anything, to change that culture and to change the response that can happen legally and otherwise? You can let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue our conversation and take your calls right after this check of the headlines with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert with Rob Ferret, and we're back with Danielle Citrin talking about cyberbullying and why women seem to bear the brunt of it online. And we'd like to hear from you on this. What do you think can, maybe should be done to make the internet more welcoming and safer for women? And how have you seen online harassment evolve over the years? What should or can be done about it? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go to our callers now. We've got Rick with us in Grafton. Hi, Rick.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
I've got about 30 years experience in IT, and the last 14 or so have been with a great team that worked with government agencies and individuals to find people who try to steal money from banks, hack banks, et cetera. And I've left that position and now got a little more time on my hands. And I also have a daughter who unfortunately, I cannot, it's disheartening to know that not only online, but everywhere women go, it seems, are being sexually harassed. And it's really getting ridiculous. But my main point on the call is I would love to start a volunteer organization of existing and or retired information security professionals that have international experience to actually help these women actually identify the individuals harassing them. I think that once you have so-called neighborhood watch of the internet of volunteers, sheepdogs, so to speak, to go after the wolves on the internet, I think, and then if they get publicized of catching these people and they get public, it'll cause a behavioral change if the government puts some real teeth into the penalties for harassment, period, but especially for women and children.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling, Rick. Appreciate that. What do you think about that, Danielle? A sort of internet neighborhood watch of volunteers.
I appreciate that comment so much because so often victims I talk to, and I work with a group called the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, so I want Rick to contact that group, which is basically an advocacy group that's trying to connect victims with pro bono counsel. And so often, victims can't sue. There are tort claims they could bring against their harassers, but they just don't have the money to hire a lawyer and to hire a computer forensic specialist to sort of track down their attackers. And so having sort of pro bono information security, technologists on the side of victims who can help them sort of trace who it is who's attacking them and then even provide that information to law enforcement, who so often do nothing about reports of online abuse, not always because they don't get it and they don't care, but because they're just outpaced by the technology. They say, like, what's Twitter? I don't get any of this. And so I think with the help of or voluntary efforts of technologists, we could have some accountability for this abuse.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Rick. And since a lot of online life right now happens on places like Twitter and Facebook, social media sites, what do you think about the way that those sites are handling these sorts of issues right now?
I mean, so there are sites and intermediaries who I think do the best that they can to address harassment and threats. So let's just take Facebook. They have fairly clear community norms and terms of service, but you know their scale is significant. So they've got 1.35 billion users, and they have four dedicated, you know, content safety teams with hundreds of people in different offices. But it's difficult to kind of respond to victims in a timely manner, and I think they can do a better job, but they're trying. So there are so many, I think, intermediaries who give us a lot of hope, right, because they want to have norms on their sites of respect. They're not saying that you have to say nice things to one another, but rather that you can't threaten and you can't harass and silence people. Of course, they're free to not do that. And there are other sites whose entire business model is revenge porn, right, or gossip. And so we have kind of the full range of online actors. Hopefully the efforts of Facebook's, those kinds of entities are an inspiration to others.
Danielle, what do you see as the root of this problem? Why do you think women are receiving the brunt of online harassment when it happens?
I mean, it's a difficult problem. To answer that question, you know, sometimes we see that it's the sort of determined person who's a scorn lover who goes after someone and then inspires a cyber mob, right? And at bottom, we see it's sort of driven by hate and bigotry, right? So that people feel threatened and they push down others. And it's cheap and easy to do with these network tools in a way that makes it difficult to find, you know, the perpetrator. But I should note that it's not just women who are targeted online. It's the majority is women. But men are targeted, too. And when they're harassed, it's very similarly in a sexually humiliating and sexually threatening way, right? So it's not just threats. It's rape threats or anal rape threats, right? It's not just privacy invasions, but nude photos. And that's much more often women who are featured in these nude photos without the person's consent. And it's not just lies, but it's lies about someone's sexuality, right? So that they have herpes, that they have AIDS. So it's in a way it sort of expresses bigotry, and it's a way that people are vulnerable, and that's the way in which we attack them.
Let's get one more call in here. Robin joins us next in Verona. Hi, Robin.
Hi. My daughter is on a TV reality television show right now, and the amount of tweets and emails that she gets from women far outweigh the ones that she gets from men. And they are so vile. They are so vicious. They're so violent. They're so hateful. They will say things like, you know, somebody should choke her. Someone should bash her in the face until she can't speak. Someone should put a plastic bag over her head. And these are all from women.
Wow.
And they far outweigh the men.
Okay, thank you so much, Robin, for calling and sharing that. Is Robin onto something? Is it unfairly assumed that it is men doing all this? It's often anonymous. Is it a civility issue that's more general?
Right. So, you know, it's actually true that women can torment, terrorize, right, other women in this way, right? And so there are cases of where the perpetrator is identified and it's a woman. So it's not to say that the gender is always of a man as the perpetrator, though there are studies that suggest that the majority of perpetrators are male, but that doesn't always line up that way. And I think the sort of the way in which we hate other people, we have self-loathing too, right? So women go after women and they express that hatefulness in bigoted ways. because we know we're vulnerable in that way. So it's much scarier, right, to a woman to have a rape threat because the threat is so real. One out of every six women faces some experience with rape in her life. So I think it's true that the gender doesn't necessarily line up with how you might think about it, but it nonetheless has the same effect.
Danielle, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back. I really appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Danielle Citrin, a professor of law at the University of Maryland, and she's the author of the book Hate Crimes in Cyberspace.